This is Puget Sound Now, a closer look at the people and issues across our community. Here's your host, Northwest News Radio's Bill Schwartz.
Record floods, a wake-up call for Western Washington.
This natural disaster is undoubtedly one of the most devastating in our state's history.
Major highways closed for months, emergency repairs to vital river levees. We talk with one King County leader who's been pushing for a better flood warning system.
We need to think about technology that can do that with respect to the flood warning center. We need to think about actual sirens in place.
The American Red Cross opens shelters for displaced residents and remind us all, make a plan.
Being prepared really just might be the difference between saving perhaps your life.
Entering Christmas break, many students won't have access to home internet.
And it's very important that students get access at home to reliable internet connectivity.
How to bridge the digital divide. Hello again, Bill Schwartz, wishing you happy holidays. Not the start of Christmas and Hanukkah week many folks could have imagined in Western Washington. Record rainfall, rivers forcing the emergency evacuation of residents from Pacific to Ordings, Snoqualmie, Tukwila, and Auburn. Washington Governor Bob Ferguson activated the National Guard to help rescue victims and fill sandbags.
I do want to take a moment to speak directly to Washingtonians who are directly impacted by this emergency. We see you. We know the situation you're in. We're doing everything we can and moving heaven and earth to get resources to you as quickly as humanly possible.
A main east-west highway, too, could be shut down for months as repairs are made between Skykomish and the Cascades town of Leavenworth. Earthen levees breached along the Green and White Rivers. 220 homeowners in the town of Pacific alerted with helicopters and bullhorns in the middle of the night. The new King County executive, Girmay Zahilai, pledging money and resources to make the necessary repairs.
Reiterate that we are going to be putting in $1.5 million as a start in disaster relief resources, but full recovery will take intense collaboration and resource sharing between federal government, state, and local governments working closely with philanthropy and nonprofit communities.
Last summer on Puget Sound Now, we spoke with a King County Council member, Reagan Dunn. He chairs the county's Regional Flood Control District. Flash floods had just claimed many lives in the Texas Hill Country. This week's flooding in Washington State reinforced his worst fears.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
You represent a good portion of King County with the rivers and streams I talked about, so Texas tragedy has to be a wake-up call for everybody living in that area.
And quite frankly, it is an example of my absolute worst fear for what could happen in the Pacific Northwest and in King County. As you know, we are a flood-prone region, and we get a lot of rain, not necessarily in Seattle by inches, but boy, there are microclimates up in the Cascade Mountains and areas where we get a ton of rain, and we have regular large-scale flood events, some of which have taken lives over the years. And so what I'm seeing in Texas is just a wake-up call, and we are now focusing on to really improve our response to floods like that one moving forward here in King County.
What do we have set up right now? What are the steps you would like to see improved?
Yeah, so we have a flood warning center in King County that gets set up before a flood event, which is good, but we don't have the kind of outreach, the kind of flood alerts, the kind of flood warning systems, including sirens, that maybe we want to have. We have a few sirens in some of the places that are typically flooded, but by and large, we don't have that infrastructure. And so this study that we passed unanimously will focus on things like outreach, evacuation plans, notification and flood alerts, improvement of that system, brochures in additional languages, video communication, things like sirens and alert systems that we really don't have in place. And we're going to come back, report back to the flood control district, and then see what we want to authorize, because we put $100 million or so every year into flood infrastructure through this district. And, you know, for a few million bucks, we can put a warning system that's in place that will, I think, potentially save lives. You know, it really isn't a question of if, but when. In 2009, we had a 90-year flood event. People were waking up along some of the river systems in King County, stepping out of their bed into ankle-deep water. We lost some houses in that event. We have had flood events that cover the Green River wall-to-wall through Kent, Auburn, and Renton back a couple of generations ago. So someday we'll have it. Very sadly, we just want to be ready for it and mitigate the damage to lives, homes, property, businesses, etc.
Let me circle back to the sirens. In Kerr County, Texas, elected leaders had been exploring them for several years and just decided it was too costly. What sort of early warning system does King County Flood Control District have, not only utilizing the sirens where you can't get cell signals, but other apparatus, let's say a NOAA radio device that would alert people ahead of time?
Yeah, so we have a flood warning center. We have an app. Go to the King County Flood Control District app. That'll give you stage alerts and things, but it's not going to wake you up at 3 in the morning. We need to think about technology. You've seen Amber Alerts and Silver Alerts come through your phone. We need to think about technology that can do that with respect to the flood warning center. We need to think about actual sirens in place. I worry about a late into the night kind of flood event. Let me give you an example. We have a lot of dams upstream. The Green River has one. The Cedar River has one. The Wright River has one. There are other, lots of other flood infrastructure dams. If you have a failure or partial failure, like we did at the Howard Hanson Dam in 2009, the potential for catastrophic flooding is very real. And so, you know, we've got to think about how we focus on improving the system. I had a meeting with Puget Sound Energy just yesterday, and they are increasing their power shutoff during emergency events like the bomb cyclone. It's designed so that power lines, you know, won't snap, come down, and start fires. The problem with that is if your flood alert system is powered by the power that PSE shuts off, it puts the whole system down. So generators, battery backup devices, all of that need to be considered. And I mean, there's no price too big. I don't think it's particularly expensive hardware, to be honest with you, but it maybe in the Guadalupe River, they couldn't justify it. But when you're talking about Kent, Auburn, Renton, massive population in those areas, I think it's an easier expense for us to justify.
Our guest on Puget Sound Now, King County Councilmember Reagan Dunn, also chairs the Flood Control District Board of Supervisors. You have this vast system right now, which has stormwater retention ponds, other mechanisms to try and divert the water and control the flow. Does that need to be upgraded?
Well, we have been doing that for about 18 years. We have been aggressively putting, you see those stormwater ponds all along the roads when you drive around King County. Those are designed to act as a shock absorber for major flood events, for stormwater runoff. And so the infrastructure we put in place, both in terms of stormwater retention ponds, as well as levee improvements, dikes and levees along our rivers, are really second to none in the country. We are really leading the country in that infrastructure. We focus on the worst first. We've been focusing on that. But what we haven't focused on is more of the human element of it, which is how do we let people know? You've maybe seen some of the brochures that we send out, be flood ready, that sort of stuff, advocating for people to get an evacuation plan. Now we need to connect the people with the evacuation plans and real-time information if we really truly want to make this the safest system it can be for the people living here.
A lot of communities, including my own, are right now upgrading their master plans, and they're forced to look at the wetlands and the sensitive, the critical areas. How does that all mesh with flood control?
Well, it's a symbiotic kind of relationship. I mean, we are improving flood infrastructure through every river and stream corridor in King County, right? And so while we're doing that, improving the levees so they won't flood, we're putting setbacks in place, storage retention ponds, some cases flood infrastructure like dams and other types of retention facilities, we might as well be improving the habitat while we do that. And so it's part and parcel. So every time we do any kind of a flood project, we're thinking about, okay, how can we make this be also hand in glove with the environment? And so, you know, my attitude is if it costs $100 to do a project and we can make it environmentally friendly for $110, let's spend that extra money. What I want to do now is add additional layer on it, which is connecting the public and public awareness of imminent flood events to that entire system, which the taxpayer has been paying for a long time around here, and they should get value.
The building continues to grow out in East King County. Gosh, it's all the way up to Snoqualmie Pass. They've got their own community up there. How does that impact floods?
Well, I heard an estimate the other day that every fully grown tree, whether it's a fir or a pine or something like a cottonwood, drinks about 80 gallons of water per day, 80 gallons per day. So vegetation, forest canopy, cover, the types of soils, all absorb water. When you're developing upstream, clear cutting or putting impervious surface down like concrete or roofing, that's not going to take in the water. And so what we see historically is you see a lot greater flood events downstream unless you mitigate with levees and things like storage retention ponds. And so what happened in Texas, the problem with Texas, my children live in Texas. I've camped in some of those river systems with them. They're in the summer, they're up here with in Woodby Island, but in the winter, they're down there during school year. That's all limestone. And so what happens is it comes through 2 or 3 inches of topsoil, hits the limestone and goes into the gullies. And those gully washers, as they call them, rip through there. It's very, very dangerous. But the same principle happens when you develop or overdevelop an area. And we got to watch for that as we're developing our flood systems.
The motion, the steps that you'd like to have in place, by when? Do you have an action plan?
There's going to be a while for us to learn the lessons down there. And then we will then meet again as a district. We will determine which ones are worthy of funding, which ones are worthy of pursuing, and we'll get some in place. I've always said I want the King County River System to be the best urban, environmentally friendly, safest urban river corridor in the United States. Certainly, we're working hard on the environmental side of it. Let's make it also the safest, not just in terms of recreation, but living within or near the floodplain so that people can feel comfortable where they're living.
Talking about flood preparedness and prevention with King County Councilmember Reagan Dunn. So many thanks for this important conversation on Puget Sound Now. Be well.
Thanks so much for having me.
Volunteers from the American Red Cross of Georgia have arrived in Washington State, assisting emergency shelters, food programs, logistics, and mental health counseling. Puget Sound Now's Lillian James says it's a perfect time to put together your emergency preparedness plan.
Today on Puget Sound Now, I am joined by Larry Bleich, the community volunteer leader and elected officials liaison for the American Red Cross, Puget Sound, and Olympics. So Larry, when disasters strike, how does the Red Cross help?
We first rank our disasters by the gravity of the situation and how much money it might cost for us to participate in that disaster. So depending on what it is, we provide different services. But for the ones most people are aware of, we provide food, shelter, and resources for people to get back on their feet. So, for instance, if there's a hurricane that happens to hit, and it's a level 7, which is our highest one, we may be on the ground with thousands of volunteers for months on end, providing shelter for people, food, and all the various resources they may need to get back on their feet.
Why is being prepared so important?
Well, I'd have to say being prepared really just might be the difference between saving perhaps your life, the life of a loved one, saving your property from destruction, and saving all of your possessions, your important possessions. So if you're prepared, you're going to be in a much better position to save those things are most important to you. As well, being thoroughly prepared for a traumatic situation, and this could be some of the worst days of your life, certainly potentially reduces the high level of stress and strain that we usually associate with traumatic events such as a disaster. So really, there's absolutely no substitute for being thoroughly prepared.
What are your best tips for being prepared?
Well, I would say the very first thing that people need to be aware of is what kind of disasters occur within the areas where we live. Most of the time when we turn on TV, we see the Red Cross engaged in the major hurricanes and the tornadoes that hit most of the country. But here in the Pacific Northwest, we don't have those kind of disasters. So we need people to be aware of what kind of disasters they might be impacted here. So when we talk about that, we're talking about wildfires. And as a matter of fact, we are headlong into the wildfire season as we speak, and there's quite a few going on in Washington State. We need to be aware of those. We need to be aware of single family fires, which are the most predominant disasters to happen to people here in Washington. Multifamily fires, such as apartments, things of that nature. Flooding, which occurs in the winter, and certainly earthquakes and the potential for tsunamis. So we have a lot of different disasters that we need to be aware of, but it's important that people recognize that they can't be apathetic to those, that they need to be prepared for anything that can happen to anybody at any time. So I would say first thing on that agenda is understand the types of disasters that occur here.
How do we come up with a plan?
Be aware of things that they need to do in advance. And that might include, such as in your own home with your family, preparing an escape route and practicing it on a regular basis. If a fire unfortunately happened in your home, would you know what to do? Would you know which exits to take? And the next thing would be always have smoke alarms in your household and test them on a regular basis. Another thing would be to have a communication plan with your family. If you got separated during a disaster of some sort, how would you get a hold of them? As well as having some sort of a communication system with people outside of your family, perhaps in another state in case all of you got displaced. It's important to understand what the emergency management system, communication system is within your community. So are they sending out emergency alerts? And are you on their distribution list in case something happens? It's important to know in your planning, let's say, for instance, you have people live in your home who are elderly or disabled. What are you going to do in the event of a disaster for them? What kind of equipment do you need to take away with you immediately and safeguard? Let's not forget our household pets. They are part of our family. 50% of America feels their household pets are family members. So you need to be prepared to evacuate them at a moment's notice and have appropriate supplies for them as well. So making a plan is extraordinarily important ahead of time.
I've heard about Go Kits. Can you tell me more about this?
Your Go Kit can vary widely in terms of, are you staying in place during a disaster or are you forced to evacuate? And if you're forced to evacuate, then you need to have something that you can put your hands on readily. That would include things like water, sufficient water for enough days away, because you may be staying with a family member, or you may be staying with a friend, or you may in fact be going to a Red Cross shelter. So in any case, you need to have something to take you that would give you peace of mind and comfort when you leave. So you need to have things like sufficient water for anywhere from 3 to 5 days. And that would include enough water, let's say 1 gallon per person per day. You need to have canned foods, flashlights with batteries, a radio that could be hand cranked in the event you don't have any electricity, which would be common. Hygiene supplies. Important to have copies, not the originals, but copies of important documents that you may lose in a disaster. Birth certificates, insurance documents, anything that's important to you, copies of passports. It's also important to have digital copies of your children and family members in case you get separated during a disaster.
How can people help their community be better prepared?
Yeah, that's a great question because, quite candidly, a lot of people become somewhat apathetic for disasters. We live in a beautiful area and we think things don't happen to us. We turn on the news and we see Florida and the Gulf Coast getting hurt by hurricanes. But, you know, we have disasters every single day, house fires and flooding and such. So it's important we're not apathetic and that we go out in the community and help train people not to be apathetic about that. You know, a lot of us live in homeowners associations, for instance. We can go to board meetings in our HOAs and have that as a topic or have somebody come in and talk to the HOAs about how to get prepared. That's extremely important. And then we as a community come together and help one another. I think another thing they could do is go to their city council and ask that to be an agenda item, talk to the mayors, talk to council members and say, hey, this is a topic we should all be informed and aware of. And a real simple thing, quite frankly, that everyone can do is download an app that's free from the Red Cross. And all that will do is tell you every single thing that I'm talking about right now in an easy to read app right on your phone. So, you know, people won't have to remember every single thing. They can go to their app and say, all right, here's what I need to put in my Go Kit. Here's what I need to do if I'm hit by a tsunami or a flood or freezing temperatures. Here are all the steps I can get involved with. And the last thing I'd probably want to say in that area is when I talk about not procrastinating, understanding what kind of communications your local emergency management organizations put out there and put yourself on their distribution list. And if, God forbid, there's an emergency that happens and they put out an alert, I would say to people, make sure you listen to emergency management in that case and evacuate. Because a big problem that we have in the world, certainly in this country, is people not wanting to evacuate during emergencies because they don't feel it's necessary to do so. They don't want to leave their animals, things of that nature. But we've eliminated those roadblocks. They can take their animals with them. They need to be assured that they have a place to go to, like I say, either to a friend or family or to a Red Cross shelter. So doing all those steps will put people in a good position to be prepared.
You can learn more at theredcross.org. That was Larry Bleich, the community volunteer leader and elected officials liaison for the American Red Cross, Puget Sound, and Olympics. I'm Lillian James on Puget Sound Now.
Now, how do we help our neighbors in need? Visit redcross.org. We're headed into Christmas break for students in Washington State with no school. Will your child or teenager have access to high-speed internet? Well, surprisingly, 17 million young folks in the United States cannot access technology. And a new partnership with T-Mobile and Boys and Girls Clubs takes on that digital divide. On Puget Sound Now this morning, we're pleased to spend a few minutes with Cassie Slane, tech and consumer products expert. Thank you so much and happy holidays.
Hey, happy holidays to you. Good to be here.
So is the digital divide in America just in rural areas like Eastern Washington out here, or do we have technology deserts in some of our cities and suburbs too?
No, you know, we have it everywhere in the U.S. You know, rural America, of course, I think that's the one that we all know. But it's really a problem that is spread across the United States because, you know, getting a high-speed internet access is expensive. And for some folks, it's a lot. And it's very important that students get access at home to reliable internet connectivity.
In my own neighborhood, Cassie, I often see students in the King County Library System or at a Starbucks working on their laptops, and it might be the only way they can access internet. How common is that connectivity issue with children and teens?
You're absolutely right. You know, it is more common than I think people realize. And like you said, according to the FCC, 17 million children in the U.S., they lack reliable internet access to high-speed internet. So, you know, so much of what they do is online, digital assignments, research, video streaming, and lessons. And it really requires more data, and it requires a reliable internet connection so that, you know, kids can really have the tools they need to succeed in school because so much of what they do now is online. In fact, over the past 5 years, technology in schools has surged 226%. So, you know, when you think about that and you think about a kid that doesn't have that access at home, I mean, that's going to be very difficult for them to just get their schoolwork done. So it's a big issue to make sure that everybody has access to that.
My daughter teaches high school English, and I was just in her journalism class, and boy, that reinforces what you just said. And I think the coronavirus pandemic forced our education system to work more virtually. So if kids can't access the internet at home, they're falling way behind, aren't they?
Yeah, you're right. You know, and T-Mobile's actually been focused on this even before the pandemic. But you're right, the pandemic really did shine a light on this disparity. And so it has been something that, you know, T-Mobile in particular has been working on getting kids connected, especially now when there is so much more online than ever.
Cassie Slane, a tech and consumer products expert, is our guest on Puget Sound Now. As you said, since 2020, T-Mobile, which has headquarters right here in Bellevue, Washington, not far from my place, has connected over 6 million students through Project 10 Million. Can you give us some details how that's been working?
Yeah, so Project 10 Million is T-Mobile's $10.7 billion digital equity initiative, and it's there to really help close that digital divide. So the program offers eligible at-risk students a free hotspot, free data plan, and access to an at-cost laptops and tablets. So that actually what you just said is to date, the company has connected over 6 million students through Project 10 Million. So it's an initiative that they're very passionate about to really get kids online so that there's an equal playing field, you know, especially with so much you know, data and online school that you need to access at home. So it's been a great initiative and successful.
How does a school, how does a child, a family know if they can qualify and be part of that program?
Yeah, so that's a great question. On tmobile.com /Project 10 Million, that's a website that you can go to find what the eligibility requirements are and how you can access the free hotspot data plan and the laptop devices. So that's a website that will have all that information on there. And you know, it's a really great website, so you can really see all of the things that you need to do and all of the access you get. You can get 200 gigabytes of data per year for 5 years, and that's a lot. That is a lot of data that is provided. So it's really going to get those kids online and access that need it.
Cassie, to my recollection, in the last 4 years, Congress did pass that infrastructure bill, which was supposed to include upgrades for high-speed internet. Do we see any tangible results from that?
You know what? T-Mobile's 5G in the U.S., so they are connected to everything. So one of the things that does is when you have a hotspot and you don't have cable, for example, in your home, you can get connected with that hotspot over their 5G network. So what that's done, that infrastructure, that's really given people like in rural communities access, you know, through the hotspot, through that 5G network that is connected, you know, throughout the U.S. Mm-hmm. So it's just enabled people to even get connected in rural areas. Yeah.
Well, as I discovered in the big power outage here in Western Washington just this month, you don't have electricity, the cable goes out, there's no cell signal, you're pretty well sunk. You have to go find one of those hotspots somewhere in the region.
Yep, that's absolutely right. You know, it's interesting because when, like, our internet's gone out a few times in our home, and my kids are, like, looking at me like, well, what in the world do we do now? Because, you know, so much of what they do is really tied to it. So it's a big thing, and if you don't have it, you know, you can't do your assignments, and it can really put you behind if you're a student and you don't have that access.
Books and board games, what a concept.
What a concept.
Let me ask you one other thing, and maybe this is a curveball, but do you think we're going to see some change in tech regulations or rules as it applies to the FCC, that maybe more people could be connected?
Boy, you know, your guess is as good as mine on what is going to happen over the next couple of years. I really hope that whatever they end up doing, they do focus on some of these disparities and getting more people connected, because I think it's very important. And as, you know, more data is required and reliable connection, it's becoming so vital that I hope whatever they do, you know, they do focus on this as an issue.
So again, to reinforce what we've been talking about, T-Mobile has a partnership with Boys and Girls Clubs of America, and it has a website where folks could find out if they qualify for these programs.
That's right. So yes, T-Mobile.com/Project 10 Million. That is a website. You can get more information about eligibility. And yeah, T-Mobile is partnering with the Boys and Girls Club of America. It's just such a great way to help more kids get access to Project 10 Million. It's a great way to get the word out and make sure that whoever needs it knows about it.
Tech and consumer products expert Cassie Slane, our guest on Puget Sound Now. Many thanks for the conversation and happy holidays to you.
Thank you. It was so good to be here. Happy holidays to you too.
Big thanks to all of our guests. I'm Bill Swartz, wishing you a joyous Christmas, Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa. Our final program of 2025 next weekend.
Thank you for listening to Puget Sound Now, a closer look at the people and issues across our community. Listen for new episodes every weekend and download full episodes at nwnewsradio.com or wherever you get your podcast. Puget Sound Now is a public service of Lotus Seattle Corp. and is a production of Northwest News Radio, 97.7 AM 1000.